From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, and this morning we speak first with biologist and paleontologist Neil Shubin, who explores the polar ice landscapes as they melt, uncovering mysteries about the ends of the Earth, journeys to the polar regions in search of life, the cosmos, and our future. Then we talk about the world's most famous bird that you may or may not know about, Flacco. It's the Eurasian eagle owl that escaped from Central Park Zoo in New York and captured the hearts of imagination and imaginations of millions of followers around the world. We speak with nature writer David Gesner. He is the best-selling author of the book All the Wild That Remains, and he joins us to talk about his book, The Book of Flacco, when we return. Stay with us. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
From meteorites frozen in Antarctica to ancient viruses reanimating in melting glaciers to a quote-unquote dinosaur dance floor where creatures trampled once tropical polar landscapes and more. And as the ice melts, it can reveal so much about our future. This is what we discussed this morning with renowned scientist, explorer, and sought-after science communicator Neil Shubin. We're pleased to have him join us today to discuss his new book, just out, Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Neil, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Neil, when I first heard about the possibility of viruses sort of hiding in ice, and as the ice melts, these viruses released into the air, I thought it was fiction that I had seen on TV. And I find out from you that indeed it is not fiction and it's real. It's not only interesting, a little scary, but very compelling. I'm wondering how you first became compelled with finding out what goes on in the ice.
Well, I was pulled to polar regions because I was studying as a paleontologist, looking for fossils to tell us about the history of life. And I was given the opportunity as a student. This is like in 1988. Okay, I was three. It was in 1988. And I was part of a four-person team to go to East Greenland to look for dinosaurs. And I never really camped before. I never had outdoor experience. And here I am, 6 weeks, Greenland, living in a tent, you know, below freezing. It was quite the experience. But that kicked off about almost four decades of polar research in both the North and Southern polar regions. And the places have just gotten in my blood. These places change the way you see the world. It really does. And when you see the polar landscape and when you communicate with the scientific community in these places who work on everything from meteorites to glaciers to ecology and polar bears and you name it, it changes the way they see the world as well. And then what makes those places special is obviously they're at high latitudes. Mm-hmm. They function at lower energy, a lower amount of solar energy comes in, and ice is the big player there. Ice has been the big player there for a long time. But that ice is so fragile. That ice has come and gone over millennia. In fact, most of the history of our planet is a history of poles without ice. You know, but our history as a species has happened at a time when there's ice at the poles. And that ice is like a library. When it freezes, it contains everything that was around, from atmospheric particles to even ancient air, to soot, to viruses and other microbes, to, you know, parts of the ancient world. So they're like the ice becomes like a time capsule, right? And as it's melting now, which is happening at an ever increasing rate, we're seeing bits and pieces from the past of the planet emerging again, and viruses and microbes are part of that.
Well, since you mentioned it and your decades long love for discovery, we just have to talk about the Tiktaalik for just a moment that you discovered. There it is. It's the fish with legs. And this was, you looked for what you believed to be something that could be found for 20 years.
Yeah, it was kind of a, we took a bet, right? So, you know, after those experiences in Greenland, I sort of gained the polar research bug and realized that there's this whole part of the world, all the rocks that aren't covered by ice in the polar regions, to explore. As a geologist, as a paleontologist, it was like a kid in a candy store. Now, the only thing is I had to, you know, this is a candy store. You need to run big expeditions to buy the candy, you know, if you will. But yeah, we identified a series of rocks up on Canada's Ellesmere Island, and actually throughout the western part of Canada's high Arctic as well, that were perfect. They were the right age, about 380 million years old, 375 million years old. They were the right type. They were formed in ancient rivers and streams in the distant past to hold these fossils. So we did a series of expeditions, and we were failures for a number of years until in 2004, we found fossils of a fish. And again, in rocks about 375 to 380 million years old, a fish with fins and scales in its back, just like any good old fish. But it had gills as well, but it had lungs, and it had inside the fin, it had bones that correspond to our upper arm, forearm, even parts of our wrist, as well as other stuff, you know, that relates to land living creatures. So here was a real mix. So when we found that, the team was just elated. And I was relieved because it took us for a long time. And I had, you know, placed a lot of bets on finding this thing. And with my colleagues, obviously, it's teamwork to do it. But yeah, it was really something.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with author and explorer and paleontologist Neil Shubin and his new book, Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Well, Neil, I am always fascinated by these deep, deep lakes that are under miles of ice that we've never explored. Have we been able to go into any of these bodies of water and actually find new things?
Well, you're not the only people who are fascinated. I mean, can you imagine the Russian, there was basically Russian, French, and American teams that did these drilling projects in the middle of the Antarctic ice cap, okay? So Antarctica is larger than the continental United States, and much of that is ice. So think of an ice block that's miles thick, the size, a little bit bigger than the United States. Did a drilling project to 2.5 or 2.2 miles beneath the surface. And they, this is back in the 90s, they found a lake that's about the size of the great, one of the smaller Great Lakes here in the Midwest, about 2.5 miles under the ice. And there are about 400 of those lakes under the ice of Antarctica, okay? And they've sampled that. So it's pretty tricky business to do that. So you do not want to, these are pristine environments that have been separated from the surface for millions or millennia, just maybe millions of years. And so it takes some high technology. The National Science Foundation of the United States, the U.S. Antarctic Program, has run a program to sample the water in these lakes. But boy, does it take some high technology. They have to treat the drill bits with UV light, make sure we're not contaminating what's going on down there. They have to be very careful to have these things sealed up so there's no lubricants or other chemicals, because drilling's a very dirty process. And they have to design robots that are sterile that can sample underneath the ice itself. And my goodness, I mean, the ingenuity that's behind this. This is one of the things in writing this book that just blew me away. The human ingenuity to be able to sample these places is just mind-blowing. And then what's even more mind-blowing is what we learn. I mean, when they pull up the waters from these places and they sample them with high technology DNA sequencing, it turns out there are critters in there. There are microbes, many different kinds of microbes. And oftentimes these microbes have been living independently of the rest of the planet for millennia. You know, and they have whole ecosystems down there that are separated from the light of the sun. You know, so they have all of these novel chemical tricks to live in these low energy environments. And they've been living and evolving independently of the rest of the planet. It's really a remarkable story of science and perseverance and technology and human ingenuity.
Well, Neil, so most of us just think polar ice, and we assume that the ice on the North Pole and the ice on the South Pole are pretty much the same, short of the South Pole having a continent underneath it, which the North Pole does not. But there's What are the differences that people find in those ice caps in terms of scientific research and discoveries?
Right, we're all familiar with ice, right? We know ice in our drinks. We sometimes slip on it and skate on it and do our human activities on it or with it. But imagine ice the size of a state or a whole continent, and it behaves very differently. And in fact, it's incredibly, in fact, ice is one of the most complicated, surprisingly complicated substances out there because it, I like to say, and there's a chapter heading in the book, one of the first ones, is called Ice is Hot. And that's a phrase that glaciologists use a lot. Ice is hot? That sounds like a Zen koan, like you'd be meditating to that or something. But no, what it means is that the ice melts at a temperature that's close to the ambient temperature of the environment. It's not like steel, which has a melting point at like 900 degrees or whatever it is. Ice is at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. That means it can just a small change in temperature can move it from liquid to solid and back again, you know? And it's at a knife edge, right? And so the ice in these places is always at the knife edge between melting into water and freezing. And that controls its behavior. It controls its size. It controls how it moves and so forth. So there's a lot of surprises here with ice. And that's kind of what I wanted to capture in the book, which is when you think about Antarctica, much of the melting of the ice doesn't happen on the surface down. It's not like it melts from the top down. Where it really melts fastest, and this is where it gets tricky, is it melts at the coast. It melts where the ice meets the ocean waters or the seawater. And there's where it gets really tricky because the seawaters are warmer and they cause the melting there. Furthermore, there are parts of the coast of Antarctica that are actually below sea level itself of the continent. So the water will seep underneath these coastal glaciers and melt them from below. So there's all these surprises there. And it's these surprises that are really controlling how much water goes from the ice into the oceans, which controls sea level, ocean, you know, ocean currents and all this other good, all this other important stuff. But yeah, it's an incredibly dynamic landscape. I mean, these places hold, you know, they're 8% of the surface area of the Earth, but they hold about 70% of the fresh water of the planet. So they're our bank of fresh water. They're our bank of ancient stuff that's been buried, that's been frozen in them from years. This is amazingly important stuff.
Neil, I remember, you know, when the Iceman that was on the border of Austria and Italy was discovered, Uzi, if I'm pronouncing it right, when he was unearthed or uniced, I guess is the better terminology for that, there was a lot of controversy surrounding this man that was found in the ice. He was incredibly preserved. And these are the kinds of things that you're finding on the polar ice caps is that A, there's so much in the ice, and B, there is controversy now surrounding, you know, whose ice it is or whose ice it was. How does that affect when you are on a team of scientists, how you go about your work?
So I'm usually part of very international teams. So in the Arctic and Antarctica, we've worked with Canadians and Australians and others. So it's a, you know, it's polar science. The scientific part of this has been very collaborative internationally. Has to be. It takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of human ingenuity of different nations to work together. So in that part, it's really great. The Antarctica is a little different from the Arctic. In that Antarctica, in the late 1950s, there was a treaty that was signed called the Antarctic Treaty. And that treaty basically committed nations to keeping Antarctica an international resource for science. So there's no militarization of an entire continent. There are no military bases there. They're only allowed to have scientific bases. And a number of countries have scientific bases there, including the U.S., Chinese, Russians, Europeans, Koreans, and so forth. The Arctic is very different. The Arctic is chopped up by countries that claim its resources. Canada, Denmark through Greenland, Russia through Siberia, the United States through Alaska, Norway through Svalbard, and on and on and on. Now, what makes the Arctic really tricky, and this is where you're going to be reading about it much more in the coming years, is because it has a geological quirk of nature that makes it internationally tricky. Underneath the North Pole, there's no continent, there's ocean, right? The sea floor underneath the North Pole has a mountain range, a mountain ridge that extends pretty much from Siberia to Canada and Greenland. And when scientists sample that mountain ridge, it turns out it's part of the continent of each place because of the history of the Earth. That means each country can make a legitimate claim for the entire ocean floor underneath the North Pole, an area several times the size of Texas. Underneath, and think about that, mineral rights, oil rights, and all that stuff. The Russians have already made a claim to the UN Committee of Law of the Sea. Canadians and Danes have as well. And they're being evaluated as we speak. I think the Russian claim was accepted. It showed the science was true. Now the diplomats will have to get to work. But, you know, there are countries going to be claiming that whole area. And I think a lot of attention is going to be, increasing attention is going to be going north and south in the coming decades.
So that makes me wonder about the degree to which you can correlate the ice cap with the ocean floor and how much it shifts and moves and things like that. So can you ever, from the top, know where you're exploring, essentially?
Well, satellites can see inside the ice. It's amazing. If I was just down in Southern California talking to somebody at JPL, you know, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. The technology there is incredible. So satellites can monitor the ice and actually see inside the ice and monitor what's going on with the ice. And in some cases, look at those lakes we talked about before and the water underneath the ice from space. You know, so you can do a lot from space. The technology has gotten ever more increasingly powerful. You can do drilling projects to look inside the ice. You can, as I said, you can drill down and you can make robots that can go underneath the water, autonomous devices, and that technology is increasing ever more. And you can do drilling projects, which are really expensive and really hard to do, and that's kind of old school, but it is actually a very powerful way to do it. And when you do those sorts of things, what you find is the polar ice in the Arctic, now we're dealing with the North now, is shrinking very fast. And this is objective. This is just, you can measure it, right? So we have ground stations that measure temperature. We have satellites that can measure temperature. And the Arctic is heating 4 to 7 times faster than anywhere else on the planet. And that's increasing because as that ice melts, it turns to water and it exposes darker rocks and darker ocean, which release more heat. So the more ice you lose, the more heat you release, and you get into this thing called Arctic amplification. And that's why, to make a long story short, you have more melting of the ice you see around the North Pole. And that ice is shrinking very, very fast. And that's why nations are looking north so much, because this area is melting. It's now accessible, you know, accessible for mineral, oil, and gas extraction, shipping lanes, you name it.
Well, Neil, you were talking earlier about how your first camping experience was on a massive ice sheet, where, you know, many of us here in Utah, we camp all the time. But I loved your section in the book where you talk about the rules of the Arctic and what it is to actually be there and to camp there. And I found it fascinating when you were talking about how it takes a bit for you to adjust to just the scenery and the topography. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one thing we don't always appreciate, particularly those of us who live in a built environment, of how connected to the planet we really are. And we are connected to the planet through many cycles we just take for granted. Light and dark is the most fundamental thing. You know, we're connected to that light-dark cycle when we know it very well, when we travel somewhere else and we have jet lag, right? But, you know, there are times we realize it, but for the most time, we take it for granted. When you pop into when you go to a polar landscape, you know, high latitude, you know, days in the summer are 24 hours long. In the winter, it's dark 24 hours. And all the cycles are different. And all the ways we connect to the planet are different. Like how we judge distance. There are no trees. There are no poles. There are no buildings. It's like being at sea. You cannot judge near and far. You know, is that a polar bear at a kilometer or is that a bunny rabbit at 20 feet? You know, it's one of those things. You know, you're always like, whoa, there's a white dot there. What is that? Is that closer part? You know, but that gives you a sense. And also the Arctic has sounds and Antarctica have sounds. The wind is incessant, right? So, you know, and your brain is trying to make sense of those sounds. And the ice has sounds too. The ice can sound like sizzling bacon sometimes as it moves. It can make booms like thunder and you look to the sky, but no, it's below you. You know, there are all kinds of sensory experiences that are disconnects for us like that. And it takes a little while to get used to that in camp. But once you do, you kind of plug into it, and it just, it changes you, right? You're just plugged into it, and you feel the planet, your connection to the planet. It's a really, I recommend it.
Well, as these areas warm and more of the ice melts and more discoveries are being uniced, if you will, do you find more and more expeditions going to these areas?
They're hard to get to, so it's not like we have a whole ton of competitors working there. But yes, there are. But the here, let me give you an anecdote which answers your question in a different way, which is I led an expedition to Ellesmere Island looking in rocks 380 million years old for more fossils this past summer in July. And we were going to a new place. And so to prepare for it, a couple years ago when I was doing the preps, I pulled out the aerial photographs that were taken by planes during the Cold War. They'd fly over these areas and take pictures. Big pictures, beautiful. I mean, incredible high resolution, done by the Canadians and the Americans for military reasons. And then I compared those photos taken in the 50s and early 60s to the satellite photos, which you can download right now, you know, from my computer, and that were taken, you know, weeks before the expedition. And the melting was dramatic. Whole areas of rock have been exposed in the six decades that since those pictures were taken that contained fossils. So the expedition that we ran this year, part of that expedition would have been on top of ice 60 years ago, which is now it's bedrock that has fossils. So yeah, it's much more of it is exposed for work. We're not seeing more activity there just because it's so expensive to work there, and it's also, you know, it takes a toolkit to be able to work there, kind of the know-how. And so it's a very small community. I'd like it to be bigger. I'd like it to be a whole lot bigger, honestly. I'd love competition up there because that's competition is good for science as it is for business and technology. But, so we're trying to foster that community up there.
Mm. We're speaking with biologist and paleontologist Neil Shubin about his book, Ends of the Earth. It was funny, when I first saw your book, Neil, I thought it was, you know, sort of the doomsday book until I saw it was ends, plural, ends of the earth, meaning the polar ice caps, the polar scape. So you talked about your own adaptability to spending large quantities of your time there. And you also talked about how different sea creatures that reside in this area have this adaptability. You talked about living where there is no light at all, and also about kind of this antifreeze that fish develop. I often wonder, you know, when you see these things living in such severe temperatures, how do they get this and how do they create it in their bodies?
Yeah, so the subtitle of the book is, it's called Ends of the Earth, but the subtitle is Life, you know, Journeys to Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. And I look at life and its special adaptations to live there, and then what we learn about the cosmos, and then the future, obviously, which is embedded in ice. But life there has adapted, as you say, in so many remarkable ways. And it's not just fish, it's all kinds of invertebrates and other things that have antifreeze proteins in their bodies. And what these natural proteins do is they stop ice crystals from forming, or they stop ice crystals from attaching and damaging cells. And these happen multiple times, and they're usually like a modification of another protein that the animal had before. It's like a liver protein in some of these fish that had a couple mutations that turns it into an antifreeze. So it's really, really amazing. But there are other adaptations as well. So there's one adaptation creatures have where they'll make a sugar called trehalose. And the sugar will replace the water in their body. That's what these roundworms do. And they'll turn into a kind of a glass, a sugary glass, almost like a candy that's brittle. And they'll stay in this suspended state when the weather gets really dry and cold. And then when it, you know, stay as this glassy state, they'll go into it. And then when the weather changes, they'll thaw out and, you know, carry on. It's crazy. But, you know, it's just one adaptation after another. And antifreeze is one of the biggest ones that we see in a lot of these creatures. But, you know, there are others, too. You know, you see polar bear hair and muskox hair and even the shapes and sizes of their bodies. You know, nature has done so many wondrous things. And just seeing how these animals cope with these extremes is really remarkable.
Of the wondrous things that you have found or learned about by all of these polar expeditions and the study you've done, what is the thing that has most blown you away that also tells us about our own future?
Okay. Imagine you're with me on expedition, and we are in Antarctica looking for ancient fish in the fossil record. And we're standing atop a mountain that's 7,000 feet high. And below us is the polar ice cap that extends for hundreds, if not 1,000 miles and a couple thousand miles in each direction. And we're at the summit of this mountain, and we're cracking rocks. And inside those rocks, we find sharks and fish and some fish that are closely related to us. And we look at the sediments of those rocks, and these rocks were clearly formed in ancient rivers and streams, kind of much like a lot of the rocks you have in Utah, and it's in the West. Imagine that juxtaposition between present and past. Inside the rocks is a tropical world teeming with life, adapting to tropical ecosystems. Outside, you're on top of one of the trans-Antarctic mountains surrounded by ice. The juxtaposition between present and past is so extreme, is so extraordinary. And it shows you how much our planet can change. And then when you study that ice, you see that change can happen very, very, very quickly. So we see the past and the juxtaposition between present and past, but also knowing ice, you see the future. You see how that the rapidity that change can happen will affect each of us, and so that's in a nutshell, that's kind of the beauty of the place.
Well, as humans, our perception of time is so limited to what we know. But when you talk about finding fish fossils and dinosaur tracks in Antarctica, and we look at that continent as being a frozen landscape, but at one time it was a tropical paradise, if you will. Where was that continent located at that time?
Yeah, so the continent at the time those fish fossils were laid down was a little bit more north, but it wasn't at the equator. It wasn't north enough to say, towards the equator, say, oh, it's warm because of where it was. Really, the climate of the Earth has changed. There was, at that time, there was less latitudinal variability in temperature as we have today. So for most of the history of our planet, there was no ice at the poles, which is remarkable. And so we can tend to think of ice at the poles because that's our human experience. But the reality is, if we were to take a time machine and go to pretty much any other time period on the planet, you would not find ice at the poles. Now, there are times when the Earth is frozen, of course, but they're relatively rarer than the times when it was a lot warmer and the poles were pure liquid. There was ocean at those poles. So yeah, so there are two things that can change that. One is the continents move around, but Antarctica hasn't moved that much in the relevant time period to explain that. The Arctic islands actually have, so it's they've behaved very differently in that way.
Now, before we let you go, and we're out of time, but I just have to ask this question about you, your exploration there, and what you are excited about exploring, and your excitement is so, so palpable and contagious, is about the ice melting and what is discovered there. What scares you about that? Because, normally this is what we hear about, climate change and the ice caps melting and what the ramifications are. So I'd love to hear the other side from your perspective.
Well, I mean, I'm going to put it more or less challenges for us together to work. And that is, as the ice melts, and it's melting much more. So just to use Greenland as an example, the ice is melting about 280 gigatons per year of ice is melting into water. That's a lot. That's up from about 40 about 20 years ago. So at an ever-increasing rate, there's water in the oceans. What concerns me is that as that water enters the oceans, we are changing the planet, that sea levels will rise. We don't know how much. It's hard to predict the future. Sea levels will certainly rise. The question is how much and over what time frame. But as that happens, global sea currents will change. You can change global weather patterns. But we're already changing the geography of many places. Pacific islands are sinking. We're seeing changes to coastal regions. So we're seeing changes to the planet. And one thing you learn when you do field work is you see your connection to the planet in a powerful way, which I don't see. I live here in Chicago, and I'm not seeing my connection to the planet, right? But, you see it, and you feel it. And, when that's laid bare, what happens is you start to see and feel what will happen if that ice changes, and what happens as coastal regions change, as weather patterns change, as perhaps agricultural belts move. We're in a changing world. You know, we're in a changing physical world. And how we adjust to that, that's up to us as a species, you know, but it's definitely going to change. Times, they are changing a lot.
Our guest is best-selling author of Your Inner Fish, and now he has just released a new book, Ends of the Earth. It's Neil Shubin, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. There's so much, Neil, that we didn't even get to talk about today, so I guess that's why we'll all just have to read your book. What a great book, and how fun to have you join Cool Science Radio. Thank you so much.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that, again, was Neil Shubin, S-H-U-B-I-N, and The Ends of the Earth. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest is nature writer David Gesner. He previously hosted the National Geographic Explorer show, The Call of the Wild, and he's the author of 13 books that blend a love of nature, humor, memoir, and environmentalism, including the New York Times best-selling All the Wild That Remains. He joins us today to explore a story he felt compelled to write a book about. It's about the world's most famous bird, Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl, and its year-long odyssey after escaping from Central Park Zoo in New York. It captured the hearts, or I shouldn't say it, let's just say Flacco, captured the hearts and imaginations of millions of followers around the world. It's a parable of freedom, wildness, and our urban ecosystems. David Gesner, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Great to be here.
It's great to have you on joining us to talk about this story that you felt so compelled about, and yet you didn't actually follow the year adventure of Flacco after Flacco was liberated from the zoo. It was something that you learned about right at the end upon Flacco's death a year later, which was a year ago now. Tell us how you got involved.
Well, first, I want to rationalize that decision to write despite not seeing Flacco. I thought, well, Tom Wolfe didn't go to outer space before writing the right stuff, right?
And I love it.
And actually, you mentioned the book All the Wild That Remains, which took place in your neighborhood quite a bit, and that was about Ed Abbey and Wallace Stegner, neither of whom I'd met, but I recreated their lives. So I figured if I could do that with them, I could do it with an owl. And really the decision to write the book occurred one day, the day after Flacco died. I happened to be in New York City because my daughter goes to NYU, which was bringing me up there a lot more than I'd been previously. And I decided to experiment and call up David Barrett, who was the kind of Twitter king of Manhattan Bird Alert, who had led people around Central Park following this Flacco, the escaped owl, and see if he'd talk to me. And he didn't only talk to me, he brought me out to the Upper West Side and showed me the final haunts of Flacco, like these water towers where Flacco hooted down into the city streets. And by the end of my talk with him, I was like, I think there might be a book here. And then it started to rain, and I ran across Central Park, and I saw the cage where Flacco had been kept. I was appalled by how small it was, honestly. And a maintenance guy, who I later called the deep throat of my book, told me, here's how they must have snuck in around the cameras. Here's how they cut it with a grinding tool. So I got to imagine Flacco escaping from this cage. And when he first did, he could barely fly. He was, you know, he'd been enclosed for 13 years, and I followed his path down Fifth Avenue to where he landed in a tree near the Plaza, the famous hotel. And then I went home and took a nap at my hotel, came back that night and visited Nan Knighton, who was a playwright, not a birder, who one day around Halloween was visited by Flacco, who showed up at the window of her 13th floor apartment, stared in with these big blazing orange eyes, and spent 3 hours, you know, and she said it changed her life after that. In fact, her her kids at Thanksgiving kept looking over at her, and she said, what, why are you looking? And she said, they said, you sure talk about that owl a lot. And so she was obsessed, as much of New York became obsessed, and I got obsessed too. But, you know, my goal was to create a double story. Me as kind of the, you know, detective Columbo guy figuring out and following Flacco after his death, but also tell Flacco's story from the moment he escaped. So it was kind of a double layered story, really.
So Flacco escaped, but these vandals, quote unquote vandals, that cut his cage open were really the liberators. They had some problem, as you did, I would assume, with the size of the cage, and said, we're going to let this little guy free. And then it was an adventure. And, you know, there's something about stories that capture the hearts and minds and the attention, you know, in part thanks to social media, but of, you know, people the world over who are interested in the plight of Flacco. What do you think that is?
Well, if you think about it, Red Tails in Love by Marie Wynne was before social media. So these things do, you know, encapsulate a certain, like, sense we have. Like, I'm mostly a solitary wanderer in nature, and I write in the book about, you know, going through snowstorms to see snowy owls. But the people who followed Flacco, some were like that, but some were, this was new to them, and it was thrilling to them, and it was like them getting into outside of themselves, into following this bird as he was harassed by crows, or as he started to fly down into the city, and they really followed him religiously. So I don't know that I know the actual reason they do it, but it sure struck a chord, you know, in so many people.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with David Gessner, and we're talking about his new book, The Book of Flacco, about New York City's most famous escapee owl. Well, David, what is it about owls? I think all of us are fascinated by them. How are we connected to them?
You know, you mentioned that I hadn't seen Flacco, but when the finally got to the end of my interviews and everything, I decided I've got to go see one. And so I asked my old Osprey mentor, Alan Poole, this great bird person, and he said, Finland's the place. So I went over to Finland. Took a Xanax for the flight to get over there, got there, woke up, and went up a cliff with this old Obi-Wan Kenobi shaman kind of guy, and was worried that I would go oh for Finland, but sure enough, there was, by the end of the evening, I was staring at an eagle owl from 20 yards away, and now I'll answer your question. Like, you know, I say in the book, you can't win a staring contest with an owl, and it's that forward-facing face, right? Unlike other birds, you know, because they can pivot their head 270 degrees. So they're looking right at you. The eyes take up more of the head than they do proportionally in other owls. And in Flacco's case, it's, and Eurasian eagle owls in general, it's this bright orange color. And you know, the cliches, the two main cliches throughout time are wisdom and death. You know, people saw them as, you know, harbinger of doom, but also wise, and it's such a human face, right? And if you look at the pictures I have in the book, you know, he's got 1,000 expressions. He emotes, he, you know, the ear tufts are down, they're up, you know, and it's pretty thrilling to you feel like you're really interacting with your fellow being, and you are, you know, with your fellow being.
Well, I remember hearing about Flacco's escape, and the whole world was rooting for this owl. What did his escape represent to us humans?
Well, I think that, first of all, the immediate reaction was most people were rooting for the zoo to recapture Flacco. The idea was he couldn't fend for himself. It wasn't safe. And ultimately, that did prove to be the case. It wasn't safe. But when he first coughed up a pellet, people were like, he's maybe hunting. And then next week they saw him catching a rat. And it was like, all right, and gradually the zoo dropped off. You know, people use the word freedom a lot, but I was a little reluctant to use it because of the current political connotations. But I think space is a physical manifestation of freedom. Like, I think I quote Thoreau in there, I like a broad margin or I need a broad margin in my life. And I said, owls too. Suddenly he went from being in this cramped space where he could barely fly, the size of the department store, you know, window, to having the Central Park and then the whole city as his place. And you saw this exciting moment of Blocko relearning those evolutionary skills and really becoming himself. And so I think for that was, you know, people who followed him, it was growth, it was space, it was breaking out of the cage. I mean, and one weird aspect, ironic aspect, I guess, or is the meta aspect where, you know, he was being filmed every second. People in Hong Kong were watching him. He was like Lady Di near the end, you know, with just harassed by media. But at the same time, he represented this kind of, for me at least, wildness. This slice of wildness that when we see it, whether we're in a national park or in the city, lets us get outside of ourselves, however briefly, and realize there's a world other than our own world.
Yeah, and also as Flacco developed resilience and adapted to that wildness, maybe it's a metaphor too for how we can break out of whatever that is confining us, and we can adapt to a wildness and we can become wild.
Yeah, let's hope so, because we need it right now. We need it.
Yeah, and it's funny because your experience with what your bird was before learning about Flacco was the osprey, and that's curious in and of itself, just why, you know, you say that's my bird, and then also right. It represented within you some kind of wildness.
Yeah, you know, I had testicular cancer when I was 30, and right after that I moved out to Boulder, Colorado, and during that time I not only adapted to a new place, and I lived, you know, hiking and running up into the mountains, but I got healthy again. And then, because my first book was about Cape Cod, which was my kind of original nature, I went back there. And I got there, and there were ospreys everywhere. And I'd seen none as a young man. They'd come back from DDT. And so that said, there's a overlap with Flacco there too, because his death, you know, has led people to fight and pass laws about bird safety, bird collisions, and against, you know, a couple neighborhoods in New York are experimenting with not using rodenticide and rat poison. Because ultimately what killed him, you know, the bird collision thing was written about a lot. That's more migrating birds that collide with buildings. And that's a horrible thing. A billion birds a year die that way. But Flacco was really destroyed by the poison in the rats he ate. And then ultimately pigeon herpivirus, where he was eating pigeons near the end when he was on the Upper West Side, and he fell to his death after those things.
Mm.
So, yeah. Also, think about rat poison. It's similar to DDT, right?
Yep.
It doesn't end with the rats. It goes into the water, into pets, and us.
Exactly. And I wanted to ask you to expand on rat poison. Are they those little rat, you know, the stations that they place outside a house to keep the rats or mice from going inside, and then the poison's in the box?
As I understand it, these are, you know, sterilizing agents that are inside a pellet that a rat would eat. So the rat isn't killed this new way, but it's sterilized, so it doesn't reproduce. That's as I understand it. I mean, I, you know, when I saw rat contraception, I did a little double take, but that's kind of what it.
Well, David, seeing some of the pictures in your book, it was obvious that a big portion of New York City was out in Central Park following Flacco, trying to get an image, trying to get a photo. But as they were looking and following this famous owl, were there any discoveries of other animals that they didn't know lived in Central Park?
Yeah, there's a great, you know, right now I'm heading up there. The book release was right now. I'm heading up there in a couple of days, and there are great photos of the coyote in the snow. There's something about a wild animal in an urban environment that, you know, is thrilling. And the park itself, I mean, I say this with Flacco, there are parts of it Eurasian eagle owls are not native to the United States, right? And they're to Europe and Russia and North Africa. Just to see this, the biggest of owls, competitive only with one other, Blakiston's fish owl, I guess it's called, to see it in, you know, on a air conditioner, on a fire escape, on a, you know, there's something about it that's exciting. It's like, oh, there's still some wildness left. And to your question, you know, zoos are supposed to educate and entertain and turn, particularly urban zoos, turn young people on to the fact that there's nature out there. So in a way, Flocko was kind of a moving zoo exhibit for people who'd never seen a bird like that, and hopefully they go on to care about other birds and to care about the natural world. I mean, it doesn't always work that way, but maybe sometimes it does.
Well, Flocko had spent its first, 13 years of its life in a zoo being stared at by humans. How did that affect its behavior once it was free?
I can't say 100%, but it did seem very tolerant of the gawkers, you know, of the paparazzi that were following it. Now, there was a schism between the more hardcore birders and the populist birders. In an inelegant metaphor, I guess I say it was like Caddyshack, where, you know, Ted Knight is the snobby country club guy and Rodney Dangerfield is the slobby populist. That was kind of the split. And there, you know, in some ways I'm on the side of snobs just because I've always had a more Thoreauvian sense of the natural world. But I really came to appreciate the people who had never birded before who were following. And sometimes they screwed up, right? Sometimes they got too close. There are stories of a couple of frat boys like harassing the owl. And people complained that David Barrett was revealing the whereabouts. But as I say in the book, the genie was out of the bottle. I mean, people were tweeting the whereabouts. And some on the snobby side actually used the whereabouts to go see the owl themselves. So there was hypocrisy on that side too. So it was interesting to see that kind of like the new world of birding, which involved Twitter, which turned into X halfway through the summer.
Yeah. So David, you're just coming on book tour for this new release of your book, Flocko. And I'm curious about, I mean, I think it's for both experienced birders, the Ted Knight portion of the birding world.
Right.
And then it's also for those people who have maybe never looked up into the trees. I mean, right? To look at birds.
Yeah, now, right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about Flocko in a way.
Yeah. That's why you throw the world's most famous bird on there as your subtitle so that you can lure these people into like, I'm not really interested in birds. Yes, you are. Come over into bird world. So
yeah,
I think so.
That's really great. I was just in the tropics and we had an app on the phone that you could, you know, for some reason here in Utah, we don't hear birds a lot. And so whenever I go to the tropics, it's like, it's just my ears are just chirping. Yeah. There's so many birds. Yeah. And so you could put the, you know, record these birds and then they would tell you what it was. And then, you know, just from the song, and then you could look them up. And I just feel like these kinds of things make people so much more aware of the wildness in our world. So what is your hope for this book?
Well, you know, it's book 14 for me, so I don't have any unrealistic hopes for it changing the world. However, I do hope a few people, like you said, who wouldn't normally venture into a bird book do. And as far as hearing birds go, I mean, that was a pivotal moment in the year, too, when Flocko never hooted when he was enclosed in that cage. And after a few weeks, all of a sudden, they started hearing these hoots at night. And later, kids in neighborhoods would hear hoots from the tops of buildings. So there was that kind of, that's another exciting aspect of Flocko's growth through the year.
Yeah. Well, our guest is nature writer David Gesner, and he is talking to us about his new book, Flocko, the World's Most Famous Bird. And thank you for joining us, David. This is really fun, and it's enlightening, but it also is, I don't know, it's a feel-good somehow, even though Flocko meets his ultimate end, right?
Yes, so that's not so feel good, but there were good repercussions from the death that are actually changing laws in New York and hopefully changing some minds as well.
Oh, yes. And before we let you go, I'm sorry, can you just briefly tell us, I know there's the law, the Flacco law about the hitting buildings, and what else?
I get the two confused. One's a Flacco Act and one's a Flacco law, but the two ones are the building collision, which despite not being how he died was a positive result. And the other is the rat contraception. There's no pigeon laws so far. I don't know what they would do to outlaw pigeon illness, except have a pigeon medic up there or something. I have no idea.
Yeah, pigeon herpes. Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew? All right. Well, David, thank you and best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And that was David Gessner again, the book of Flacco, the world's most famous bird. I love those kind of stories. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. And thanks to our guest today. We spoke with biologist and paleontologist Neil Shubin, who explored with us the polar ice landscapes as they melt and as they uncover mysteries about the ends of the earth and our future and even the cosmos. And then again, David Gessner about the book of Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl that escaped from Central Park Zoo.